is Farhane v. United States of America. I'm told all the lawyers are here, and so we've allotted 25 minutes per side. If judges are interested, we may go a little over, but that's the plan. I understand, Mr. Kassem, that you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right? All right. So give us a chance just to get all these notices out, and then we'll proceed in just a minute.
Thank you.
All right. Everybody ready? All right. You may proceed. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. A competent defense lawyer in 2006 representing a client he knows to be a naturalized U.S. citizen who's facing serious charges stemming from years-old conduct should, at a constitutional minimum, alert his client to the possibility that pleading guilty to pre-naturalization conduct could lead to deportation. Because Abdulrahman Farhane's defense lawyer never warned him about the deportation risk, the straightforward application of Padilla and Strickland should bring this court to vacate Mr. Farhane's guilty plea and conviction. The court could also follow Padilla's reasoning to find that the distinction between collateral and direct consequences is as ill-suited to denaturalization as it is to deportation. A ruling in Mr. Farhane's favor here would impose only a minimal burden on defense lawyers because it is not very different from what they already do. And because there are fewer denaturalization cases than deportation cases, the ruling would only be relevant to a comparatively small number of cases. At the same time, the impact of denaturalization and deportation on clients and their families could not be more severe. In other words, the cost is low and the benefit high to defendants and to the integrity of proceedings. By contrast, the implication of the district court's ruling below and of the government's position here would be absurd. There is no dispute that had Mr. Farhane been a lawful permanent resident instead of a naturalized U.S. citizen at the time he pled guilty in 2006, then his defense lawyer's failure to advise him of the deportation risk would have been deficient under the Sixth Amendment. The government has already conceded as much. Mr. Farhane essentially would be penalized for going through the arduous...
they are different risks, right?
Your Honor, they are different risks, but they are both particularly severe immigration consequences, and they are the only two severe immigration consequences that have been likened by the Supreme Court.
To many collateral consequences, there are many severe consequences.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Sex offender registration, being stripped of all of your assets in forfeiture, all of those things.
Of course, Your Honor. All of those other collateral consequences that you have named, the law is well settled. With respect to denaturalization and deportation, those are the only two that the Supreme Court has mentioned in a single breath as being the equivalent of banishment, exile, the loss of all that life, of all that makes living life.
They've never reached a decision on collateral versus direct as far as naturalization is concerned.
Your Honor,
that's what we're doing here.
Your Honor, this court could simply apply Padilla. Mr. Farhane was not warned about the deportation risk at play in the plea that he was advised to take.
Well, so I've looked at all of the various documents that you've supplied in terms of what the standards were back in 2006. Now, we're talking now about the current situation, 2017. But looking back at those consequences and the standards that existed at that time, particularly with the ABA, there's a long list of collateral consequences that they think would be a good idea for the lawyers to advise their clients on. They're considered collateral there. They're used the term collateral. But there's a very long list of consequences, and they go into it in great detail. But nowhere is there a reference to warning about warning a U.S. citizen about the possibility of denaturalization and possibly leading to deportation. There's all sorts of references to doing that with respect to a person who is an immigrant, I mean, who's an alien in the country, and that's sort of standard practice then for the ABA to have those standards, but never for a citizen.
Well,
I'm wondering about two things. First of all, we know that this was a very rare occurrence, and secondly, the standards really didn't apply to this kind of a situation. And if the ABA couldn't come up with a reason to give a warning to a potential pleading guilty, how could it be reasonable for Farhane's lawyer to do it?
Your Honor, if you'll allow me 2 points. On the denaturalization point, the very treatise that the Supreme Court cited in Padilla, the 2003 edition of Toubi, mentions denaturalization risks stemming from post-naturalization pleas to pre-naturalization conduct, and it cites cases that mirror what is happening to Mr. Farhan today. And so denaturalization was not an unknown risk. That was a resource that was mentioned in Padilla. New York State Defenders Association's...
The fact that there could be denaturalization obviously goes with any time that there's a naturalization. But the fact that the lawyers were required to warn of that is not... I couldn't find it in any of the materials.
Your Honor, the prevailing professional norms are the expectations and practice of the legal community. That's what the Supreme Court said in Padilla. And so had Mr. Farhan's trial counsel simply learned...
But those norms don't draw the parameters of the Sixth Amendment. Padilla is quite clear about that. Padilla set out and tried to extrapolate, and Justice Kagan's opinion in Chaffetz after the fact says what they were doing there was they were trying to understand around what legal relationships does the Sixth Amendment attach. And in Padilla they said the immigration in the confluence of immigration and criminal law is so unusual that the characterizing something as collateral or direct doesn't work. Isn't that the case?
Your Honor, correct.
And she was quite clear in saying this was new ground. This was brand new ground. And that the norms of practice don't become relevant in understanding or evaluating prejudice or performance until after one understands that there's a constitutional premise of effective assistance of counsel working within the relationship. The relationship between the lawyer and the individual being represented, the individual who's charged with the crime and perhaps facing deportation. The person charged with the crime, and I presume you would say, facing denaturalization, correct?
Your Honor, again, our position is that Mr. Farhan faced a risk of deportation about which he was not warned by his trial counsel. So under a straightforward application of Padilla.
Padilla established that relationship, not the ABA.
Well, Your Honor, Padilla in section 2 of the opinion in Padilla.
The fact that a really good lawyer might think about that doesn't define the parameters of the Sixth Amendment's protection, does it?
Your Honor, what the Supreme Court held in Padilla, looking back to as early as 1995, that advice about the deportation consequence was part of the prevailing professional norms, at least going back to 1995. The court in Chaida has actually dated it back to 1968. What the court did in Padilla was that it decided based on the severity, the particular severity of deportation and the intimate relation that it bears to the criminal justice process.
Based on the intimate relation, right? So the Supreme Court says it's nearly automatic and practically inevitable if he's convicted that he's going to be deported. Isn't it different here? So in Padilla, the conviction itself makes him deportable, right? Whereas here, the conviction is neither necessary nor sufficient for the denaturalization proceeding, right? Isn't it right that we could vacate Mr. Farhan's conviction and the government could still pursue the denaturalization by introducing all the evidence that he committed the crime and therefore had bad moral character or misrepresented something willfully in the immigration proceeding? Or the conviction could stand and he could still argue against denaturalization on the ground that it wasn't willful or knowing, or that there are some insinuating circumstances that made him have good moral character, right? Well, so it's not as automatic as the deportation consequences in Padilla. Right?
Well, Judge Menasche, the denaturalization and deportation consequences at play here are automatic. They may be different from the exact mechanisms that were at play at Padilla.
How could it be automatic? Didn't it take the government 12 years to bring the denaturalization proceeding, and they didn't bring it until after it seems like they decided to do it much later on.
Your Honor, the passage of time is irrelevant to the Padilla analysis. There are many pure deportation cases where removal proceedings are not initiated for an extensive period of time as well. The important thing here is that though the links in the chain may be lengthier, more numerous in this particular case, Padilla actually accounts for that. Padilla says where the law is clear, as it is in Padilla, clear advice is owed. And where the law is less clear, where there's some attenuation, there's more complexity to the legal risk analysis, then counsel must still say something. And here, Mr. Farhan, who was owed advice about both denaturalization and deportation, importantly, was told nothing.
Sorry, you're saying Padilla says that where there's an attenuated risk, counsel still needs to say something?
Exactly, Your Honor.
The Supreme Court in Padilla says they're creating an exception to the normal collateral, non-collateral distinction because of the nearly automatic consequence.
But, Your Honor, the Supreme Court in Padilla accounted for a range of complexity in legal analyses. And so when it comes to immigration, because immigration law is complicated, sometimes the causal chain may be longer, more complex, more obscure. And in those circumstances, trial counsel must still say something. Lack of clarity in the law, the Supreme Court said in Padilla, does not obviate
the need. And not just lack of clarity. Doesn't Padilla say unclear and uncertain?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Can it be uncertain and automatic at the same time?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, you could take the example of Mr. Farhan's case. His lawyer advised him to plead guilty to a pre-naturalization aggravated felony. Now, that aggravated felony automatically disqualifies him from naturalization, subjects him to denaturalization, and the same aggravated felony, once he is denaturalized, will make him automatically deportable. So when you look at the lead count in the denaturalization complaint in the Eastern District, the illegal procurement count, that count is made out automatically by the aggravated felony that went unwarned.
But that's not a function of whether there's a conviction, right? It's a function of the facts in question go back to the earlier period, 2002, 2001. And those facts exist today. They existed then. That was what triggered the initial civil denaturalization proceeding. And then it was filed. Now, the criminal case comes along, and then that. All you get is, all the government's advantage there is, they get a collateral estoppel on the facts that he admitted to. It's just an evidentiary point that's made. It could be proven all sorts of different ways in a civil denaturalization with or without a criminal conviction, right?
No, Your Honor, this case is not a case about collateral estoppel. It's about the legal effect of a conviction and whether a person in Mr. Farhan's position...
What's the legal effect of the conviction beyond collateral estoppel? It's just basically... Telling Farhan that he has he can't gainsay what the government is saying he did back in 2001 and 2002.
Well, Your Honor, let me try to get at the question a different way. Collateral estoppel is also a play in removal proceedings, and removal can also be established based on conduct and not a conviction. So the fact that you can establish denaturalization or deportation based on conduct or a conviction doesn't resolve the issue here.
And isn't it correct that there was no civil denaturalization proceeding that was instituted as a result of the conduct, although the government was fully aware of the conduct because there was a confidential informant involved?
Absolutely.
It was only after the criminal proceedings on the false statements and the conspiracy count, and after he had served his term, a year after finishing his term of 13 years, that is when the civil denaturalization began.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It was only after Mr. Farhan had served 11 out of 13 years and been released on good conduct, a year after his release was when the denaturalization proceedings were initiated.
If in fact your side prevails on this particular point, leaving out the ineffective assistance of counsel, stripping calculus, that the government is free to proceed with civil denaturalization. They just couldn't use the contents of the... They couldn't use the contents of the guilty plea.
Your Honor, the fact that the government may proceed with an entirely different civil denaturalization case is neither here nor there for
purposes. It's the same case that they've started.
Well, Your Honor, but it's neither here nor there for purposes of the Padilla analysis. The Padilla analysis is about the advice that is owed when there is a risk of a particularly severe immigration consequence at play.
Here, severe and automatic. Those are the two.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Discussed, right?
That is correct, Judge. And on the automatic point, again, here one need only look to the nature of the conviction. It is an aggravated felony conviction that predates Mr. Farhan's naturalization.
You're saying it's automatic after he's been denaturalized. The point is, denaturalization is not automatic.
Well, Your Honor, neither is deportation. So the Padilla analysis...
Well, no, but the point is that the immigration laws require that certain convictions mean automatic deportation, right?
Right, Your Honor, but
automatic... There may be discretion and there may be slip-ups, but the point is that they statutorily It is required. That is the result of the conviction.
Your Honor,
could I actually ask you to clarify that? Is it deportable that you become, or you become deported? You automatically get served and notice to appear.
You become deportable, Your Honor, and as this court well knows from reviewing numerous immigration cases that linger on the dockets endlessly, the initiation of removal proceedings or denaturalization proceedings is not immediate. That is an act of executive discretion, and that may happen immediately, or it may happen 10 years into the future. Once it happens is where the Padilla analysis kicks in. That's where the word automatic gains its meaning. In other words, when Padilla speaks of an automatic consequence, it is not speaking about the initiation of removal or denaturalization proceedings. It is talking about what happens legally, what is the legal risk once those proceedings are initiated. And you can take the conviction at issue in Padilla itself. That was a 2001 conviction. Mr. Padilla was not in removal proceedings for that conviction.
So you're saying even if denaturalization were extraordinarily rare, which I guess it is, but assume it's even more extraordinarily rare, let's say there's one denaturalization every 100 years, we shouldn't think about what they say in Padilla about how it's automatic and how our practice is that many people are just automatically deported after committing a crime. You should only think about the automatic nature of it once that proceeding is brought.
That's
even if it was unheard of that people were denaturalized.
That's correct, Your Honor. Well, denaturalization was not unheard of, and we can talk about extensive.
No, it sounds like argument is that even if it is unheard of, even if it almost never happens,
sure,
Padilla still covers it because the language about automatic only applies once the government decides to bring it.
Your Honor, the Padilla analysis does not turn on trial counsel's assessment of the odds of a particularly severe immigration consequence, whether it's some form of deportation or denaturalization, and it doesn't turn on even the court's assessment of the probability of that particularly severe immigration consequence. It really turns on whether the legal risk is present. Padilla repeatedly talks about a risk of deportation and how advice is owed. Now, again, where the law is clear as it was in Padilla, where the legal consequence is clear and the causal chain is relatively short, then clear advice is owed. But Padilla itself says...
Padilla says carries the risk of deportation. It doesn't say that carries the risk of an automatic deportation.
That's correct,
Your Honor. That it's imminent, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The district court relied on the lack of imminence.
Well, I would say, given the amount of discretion and the delay, how helpful is the term automatic in any of this as a practical matter? I mean, we're not talking about mathematical certainties in any context. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Judge Perez. And again, that's the point I was trying to make earlier about the meaning of the term automatic. It does not mean imminent. It does not mean immediate. Clearly in the Padilla analysis, it is about the risk assessment. It's not about practical risk. It's about legal risk. And so once removal proceedings are initiated, once denaturalization proceedings are initiated, how automatic is the particularly severe immigration consequence? And I just want to be clear on one point. It doesn't require everyone to lose. It just means the mine run of cases will result in deportation or denaturalization.
Why would the mine run of cases involving denaturalization automatically end in denaturalization? Because I thought you had to prove, if you're the government, not just that the crime was committed, but that it was willfully concealed or misrepresented. I mean, isn't this a lot like, I don't know if you're familiar with Rahafe, which is, the felon in possession statute, where now not only does the government need to prove that you were a felon in possession of a gun, but that you knew you were a felon.
Well, Your Honor,
so you have an additional mental state. So you have to prove, if you're the government, not just that a crime was committed, but that you knew what you did was a crime, which in criminal mens rea terms usually would refer to willfulness, which is generally not an element of a crime, and I believe is not an element of crime to which your client pled guilty.
Your
Isn't
Honor,
that's a big hurdle, and we reverse plenty of criminal cases where the government has not made that showing.
Your Honor, in this case, one need only take a look at the denaturalization complaint that the government filed in the Eastern District of New York and the supporting affidavit by a special agent, the affidavit of a good cause. That denaturalization complaint repeatedly references the conviction, the guilty plea, so does the affidavit, and that's with respect to all three denaturalization counts.
But it wasn't necessary for it to do that, for him to get denaturalized, was it? I mean, you could bring the denaturalization proceeding independent of any criminal.
Your Honor, you are correct, but you can also bring a removal proceeding based on conduct. And if, for example, in a criminal proceeding, a client is not advised about pleading to conduct, not a conviction, conduct that makes them removable, then that conviction, that plea is itself can be vacated subject under Padilla. And we've cited cases to that effect. There are cases we haven't cited, like People v. Saunders here in New York in 2021, where, again, it is a conduct-based ground of removal that was admitted as part of a plea process that was vacated because the plea was unadvised as to the removal consequence of the conduct.
Just going back to civil denaturalization, you could bring a civil denaturalization based upon a poor moral character that had nothing to do with the conviction. There wouldn't have to be a conviction at all. You just go back and you put on the recordings, and that's the poor moral character, and then he can try and defend himself if he wants to on that. But I'm seeing two different proceedings that are really unrelated to one another, except for the fact that they converge only at the point of his conviction in the sense of how it might be used in a civil denaturalization case. But a civil denaturalization can be achieved without the conviction. The conviction is not necessary for it. Yes, the government could rely on it in the sense of it gets an effect.
Well, Your Honor, I guess the short answer is, you know, if you are facing denaturalization or deportation based on conduct without a conviction, then you wouldn't have an ineffective assistance of counsel claim in relation with the criminal justice process. I mean, we are here today because Mr. Farhan was not advised about the deportation consequence.
Could Mr. Farhan lose his citizenship premised on lying on his naturalization application? Because that's one of the things that alleged occurred here. The application to take his citizenship away is not premised on his conviction, correct? You're to lose your citizenship because of your conviction.
Your Honor, the affidavit in support of the first count cites the conspiracy to commit the crime of money laundering. That is the actual crime of conviction, illegal procurement, the lead count. And if you look at the other counts,
it's premised on the lack of good moral character, right? And that includes whether you committed a crime. But even if he's convicted, he could also argue there was extenuating circumstances under the statute, right?
Well, Your Honor, we aren't aware of any defenses to the...
Let me ask you this again.
Sure.
In the statute that defines what the qualifications or the conditions are to denaturalize someone, is a conviction of this crime mentioned?
Your Honor,
Let me finish.
Your Honor, if
so
I can
presume that he remains that he's denaturalized, it's not because of his conviction, is it?
No, Your Honor, it is because of the conviction.
Presume that he's denaturalized, but he's still convicted. What happens to him?
Your Honor, so if he is denaturalized and the conviction stands, then he is automatically deportable because it's an aggravated felony that was committed pre-naturalization.
So the conviction speaks to his deportability in terms of it, because under the immigration law, a conviction for a crime of moral turpitude or aggravated felony of which this constitutes an aggravated felony becomes the grounds upon which he is deported, is that correct?
So, Your Honor, this conviction for an aggravated felony automatically disqualifies him for naturalization. That's by operation of law. And so it subjects him to denaturalization, again, by operation of law. And it's the same conviction that makes him deportable. And so our point is, since there is a deportation consequence, however remote, he was owed advice about it.
My only suggestion to you is that this doesn't seem to me to be Padilla, but it does seem to me to be Padilla plus, in the sense that his conviction does bear some relationship to his immigration status once his immigration status becomes relevant.
Your Honor, so it is Padilla again to the extent that Padilla anticipates scenarios like this where the law is not succinct, not as straightforward as it was in Padilla, where the causal chain may be lengthier.
What I'm suggesting is, doesn't this seem like it's an extension of Padilla then? Giving him relief requires us to take Padilla a step further than Padilla exists, because Padilla is talking about what the Sixth Amendment protections are for a person who's in immigration status who's charged with a crime. This is a naturalized citizen who's charged with a crime. What are the Sixth Amendment protections, and what are the obligations of counsel with regard to making sure that their Sixth Amendment protections are proper?
Well, Your Honor, our view is that what counsel did here, it's undisputed that counsel knew that he was representing a naturalized citizen facing very serious charges stemming from years old conduct. And so it's not a leap to infer that counsel knew that the conduct predated Mr. Farhan's naturalization.
But once the deal was decided in 2010, only two states in the entire country, New York being one of them, I might add, only two states in the country imposed an effective assistance of counsel obligation upon an attorney representing someone in a criminal proceeding to appreciate the immigration ramifications of a conviction. No circuit in the country recognized such obligation.
Well,
so the fact that there may be good lawyers doesn't mean that bad lawyers are bad lawyers in the sense of lawyers not as good or as well-armed with regard to their responsibilities are acting in an unconstitutional
way. Well, Your Honor, we can only apply Padilla. And what Padilla did was it acknowledged your point, Your Honor, but then it looked to prevailing professional norms as reflected by the practice and expectations of the legal community. And it noted that at least as early as 1995, lawyers were being instructed to advise on deportation consequences. The Supreme Court in Chavez brought that back to 1960.
One of the norms that you have cited prior to 2005 dealt with non-citizens, and is in the context of non-citizens and immigration consequences that might flow from that.
Your Honor, again,
aspirational points that you
again, Your Honor, a treatise that the Supreme Court cited in Padilla, the Toobie 2003 edition, talks specifically about denaturalization risk. The New York State Defenders Association Deportation 101 resource, which, by the way, is not just a resource, it's a reflection of the curriculum on which defense lawyers were trained at the time, that warned about denaturalization risks. And had Mr. Farhan's trial counsel just picked up the phone and called the Immigrant Defense Project hotline, what they would have said to him was, beware of the denaturalization and deportation risk in this sort of case because you are advising your client to plead guilty to conduct alleged to have occurred when he was still a non-citizen.
Well, how do you explain the fact that 1999, the ABA came up with the standards that you cite and that you rely on very heavily about what to do with all of these various consequences. And not once in there is there any reference to denaturalization as a predicate to deportation as something that needs to be warned about. After they've listed everything else, my question is, and this goes really to the Strickland point, how can it be unreasonable for counsel not to warn under those circumstances when the ABA, after studying and doing all the research and everything they could to come up with every conceivable possibility, didn't think of denaturalization as a prelude to deportation as a warning requirement?
Well, Your Honor, even if we concede that denaturalization is more rare than deportation,
well,
it was not unknown.
Your Honor, you have
multiple Supreme Court cases. You have Cundis, Fedorenko, Costello. You have Second Circuit cases, Reimer, Rossi, Otto, Asher. And you have a case that comes out and that's widely reported 1 year before Mr. Farhan's plea, Jean-Baptiste, which matches the exact same scenario at play here today with denaturalization. So the risk was not unknown. We found 87 denaturalization cases.
If there's a risk of harm, serious harm,
correct,
then you're saying that under those circumstances, there should be a constitutional protection.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And if you say that, I want to know what the limiting principle is, because there are thousands of different consequences, loss of permits, loss of, I've mentioned them already, some of the sexual offender registration. Things are very serious.
Your Honor, the law is well settled with respect to all of these other collateral consequences that you have named. Denaturalization and deportation are the only particularly severe immigration consequences
sure
that the Supreme Court has mentioned
all
in one breath.
Others. I mean, I do think it's worth exploring what are the limits if we adopt your view on the Sixth Amendment. I mean, the one that keeps coming to mind for me is, well, what about extradition? Natural born citizens who plead guilty to a crime in the United States, but it's a cross-border crime. So they have to be advised that maybe they could be extradited to a different country and face prosecution and imprisonment there?
Your Honor, our contention is far more modest. If you have a defense
lawyer. But why wouldn't that be just as severe, and why wouldn't it be something that would matter to a criminal defendant?
Your Honor, so the reason the Supreme Court equated denaturalization and deportation is because they are the equivalent of losing everything that makes life worth living. They are the equivalent of banishment or exile. The Supreme Court has not said about any of these other collateral consequences.
In a Dominican jail, that's the same as banishment as well, I imagine.
Your Honor,
are we really talking, though, about what is the scope of Padilla? And Padilla focused on the increased risk of deportation and being banished, in essence, from this country, losing one's citizenship, but deportation in particular. And just applying the language of Padilla, there's the core loss of citizenship that was automatic, as well as even when the circumstances and the consequences are somewhat less automatic or it's harder to know it from an immigration law perspective what they will be. But I don't think we have to jettison the direct collateral distinction wholesale in order to look at Padilla as applicable to the increased risk subjected that Mr. Farhan was subjected to in these circumstances. Do you think we have to go further than that?
Absolutely not, Judge Carney. In fact, again, this court could rule in Mr. Farhan's favor in one of two ways. One would be, again, a direct application of Padilla because he was not advised about the deportation risk. The other pathway would be to apply Padilla's logic, to follow the steps in Padilla and reach the conclusion that denaturalization, like deportation, is ill-suited to the direct collateral framework.
But then we would need to apply Strickland, and then we have to look at what were the prevailing standards at the time, right? And we have to look and see if he had shown prejudice.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we just have to get past the initial, is this a Sixth Amendment problem or is it not?
Correct,
Your
Honor.
And then apply to Strickland, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And once you get to Strickland, you know, Mr. Padilla has met the standard for prejudice that applies under the J. Lee case from 2017. There's no dispute that he was prejudiced. There's really...
I have a question about Teague. I understand your argument about that we're just applying Padilla, so it's not a new rule, but the standard is that the result has to be so dictated by precedent that I guess reasonable jurists couldn't disagree. And so there's no cases advocating the position that you're asking us to take today. We're all here today, so how is this not a new rule barred by Teague?
Your Honor, setting aside our arguments on sort of forfeiture and to respond to your question, our contention is that this is merely the application of the principle that governed a prior decision, Padilla, to a different set of facts, and Teague and Chavez recognize that.
So the application of Padilla is so clear that reasonable jurists couldn't disagree about it?
Your Honor, the application of Padilla cannot be that you are entitled to advice about particularly severe immigration consequences such as deportation unless you naturalize at some point in the future. If the conduct occurred when you were a non-citizen, then you should be just as entitled to the Sixth Amendment's protection regardless of what happened to you subsequently.
But Padilla did not involve a U.S. citizen.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's
and there's no mention in Padilla of denaturalization as a predicate to deportation. And in so many words.
And that's why, Your Honor, again, you know, citing Chavez, looking at Teague closely, we are saying this is a rule of general application that was meant to apply to myriad factual contexts, and this is a different factual context. We get to the deportation consequence here through a different pathway.
It's a rule of general application, and part of the general application is that the collateral direct distinction is not helpful, should not be used. Then you're saying basically something a little different from what Judge Carney said, that you'd rather see this decided on the basis of a case-by-case method, case-by-case analysis of each case of whether the consequence is captured or not by the Sixth Amendment.
Well, no, Your Honor, we're not saying this is a case-by-case. We're merely saying apply Padilla. Padilla is about the legal effects of a conviction, the legal risk in a particular plea process. Here, there was risk of a particularly severe immigration consequence to, in fact,
but Mr. Farhan says repeatedly and repeatedly non-citizen. And you are sort of asking us to ignore that and say that it really means something much broader.
No, Your Honor, Padilla was focused on deportation risk. It talked about risk of deportation.
No, it says non-citizen.
It does say non-citizen, Your Honor, but that's because that is the class that normally deportation risk applies to, and there will be... But this is also an easily identifiable class of people to whom deportation risk would also apply. So again, what we're saying is not very different from what lawyers are doing already. We're only asking them to really ask one more question if we're talking about trial counsel in Mr. Farhan's case, which is, when were you naturalized? When did you become a U.S. citizen? What we know in this case, it was obvious, you know, trial counsel knew as early as the first hearing that he was dealing with somebody charged with years-old conduct.
Isn't that asking lawyers to provide a different kind of advice, right? So in Chavez, we know that Padilla announces a new rule because you asked this predicate question about whether the Sixth Amendment even applies. And you're saying we're asking lawyers to ask an additional question. When were you denaturalized? And so can I evaluate the possible denaturalization consequences of your plea? Don't we have to answer the question as to whether the Sixth Amendment applies to that?
Yes, Your Honor, and again, the way
you're asking the same extra thing here that the Supreme Court said was the extra thing that made it a new rule in Padilla, right?
Your Honor, the new move in Padilla, you know, as recognized in Chavez, is the recognition that deportation is ill-suited to the direct collateral framework. Now, Padilla did that work, as Chavez recognized, and Mr. Farhan is entitled to invoke that rule.
Denaturalization is the equivalent of that or something different, because we've been talking about the distinctions between a denaturalization proceeding and just a deportation of a non-citizen, right?
Well, Your Honor, again, just to be clear, one way to rule in Mr. Farhan's favor is to say some deportation risk here went unwarned. Another way to rule in his favor is to follow the logic of Padilla and to deem a denaturalization.
Okay, that second option would be announcing a new rule.
No, Your Honor, it would not. It would just be the application of Padilla's analysis.
So there's two ways. The first one is just the application of Padilla. The second one is to apply the and logic to denaturalization proceedings.
Section 2 of Padilla is a part of the opinion. Mr. Farhan can invoke any part of the majority opinion in Padilla because his conviction became final after Padilla. And so he can invoke the analysis in Section 2, and applying that analysis should lead this court to the conclusion that the direct collateral framework is as ill-suited.
It's not a new rule because we're applying the same logic.
You're applying the analysis, which the Supreme Court in Chavez recognized was the new move in Padilla. It was the analysis in Section 2 of the Padilla opinion.
Padilla involved a legal permanent resident, I think, right?
Correct, Your
Honor.
But
presumably it would apply to other kinds of deportable aliens, even if that meant an extra question to be asked by counsel to figure out what the level of risk was and the like.
Correct, Your Honor. And it has been applied that way for folks who are not lawful permanent residents. And for Mr. Farhan, again, our view is that trial counsel knew or should have known that they were advising him to plead guilty to pre-naturalization conduct. And if trial counsel did not know, then it was unreasonable not to ask the question, knowing everything that trial counsel knew, it was unreasonable not to ask the question, well, when did you become a U.S. citizen? Because that would have given trial counsel all the information trial counsel needed to figure out that they were advising Mr. Farhan to plead guilty to conduct that was alleged to have occurred when he was still a non-citizen, occasioning particularly severe immigration consequences. Here, it's denaturalization and deportation. So the causal chain, there may be more links in the causal chain, but there is still a risk of deportation that went unwarned. And so Mr. Farhan,
the record tells us about the prejudice question that even if he were so advised, he would have risked the 30-year sentence and not accepted the plea.
Your Honor, he would not have been risking a 30-year sentence. So let's imagine he had gone to trial. He would have faced 23 years. Now, we've looked at cases.
10 years more.
Well, Your Honor, let me finish the point. He would have been sentenced in all likelihood concurrently, not consecutively. Sabir, one of his co-defendants, was sentenced 5 years below the maximum. He would have been capped at 15 years. That's a two-year delta between the 13 years he got through the plea, the 15 years he would have been facing at trial. That's the exact same difference in Jay Lee. And in Jay Lee, the Supreme Court said Mr. Lee had no real defense at all. And the fact that it was a two-year difference between what he got through.
But in Lee, Mr. Lee kept asking about deportation consequences all the time. Like, he was asking his lawyer all the time. And so, well, is there something like that in the record here?
Well, Your Honor, that's simply because, you know, Mr. Farhan should not be faulted for a second time for his counsel's ineffective assistance. It's exactly what a panel of this court recognized in Rodriguez. If you're not aware of the deportation risk, you shouldn't be expected to talk about it. But there's plenty of contemporaneous evidence in the record, similar to Lee, Your Honor. In terms of, and similar to cases like Rodriguez in this circuit, in terms of Mr. Farhan's tenure in this country, how long he was here, the fact that he is the father to six U.S. citizen children and grandchildren, the fact that he was a business owner, the sole breadwinner, all of these facts by themselves, again, with respect to Mr. Lee, who had no real defense, were deemed enough as a matter of law to make out prejudice.
Statements that were admitted at his trial where he says, we shouldn't think of this as our country, we shouldn't stay here in the long term. Right? I mean, doesn't the record suggest that actually it wasn't a priority to save the United States?
Well, Your Honor, this court should not credit unsworn, casual remarks. The recordings that you're referencing, Your Honor, the recordings that you're referencing were recordings that were made by Muhammad Al-Ansi, an informant, who this court found had severely damaged credibility. Now, what Mr. Farhan would have done had he been advised about the deportation and denaturalization consequences, is he would have called Mr. Alansi the same as the Almuaya defendants did. He would have exposed him and his lack of credibility. Mr. Alansi attempted to self-immolate in front of the White House. All of this was known at the time of Mr. Farhan's plea. Had Mr. Farhan been advised?
Your Honor, his recordings are not genuine.
Your Honor, our argument is that he had a viable defense. And frankly, under the Lee standard, he doesn't even need any.
Is what? That the person who made the recordings?
Is unreliable. He had an entrapment defense. We don't even have complete recordings, Your Honor. The trial counsel noted that there were conversations that went unrecorded. There were conversations that were cut short. All of that is in the record before this court. That's more than enough. There is a surfeit of evidence here to make out the prejudice standard in Lee. The prejudice standard in Lee, the bar is actually very low compared to what we have in this case. In Lee, he had no real defense at all. He had deep U.S. ties. Mr. Farhan had real defenses and the same U.S. ties. And he is a U.S. citizen. He has more to lose than Mr. Lee. Mr. Lee was a lawful permanent resident. So
isn't it the case that Mr. Lee had reason to be asking repeatedly about whether he was vulnerable to losing his citizenship, whereas Mr. Farhan had no reason? In fact, many people who are naturalized citizens think it's permanent, can't be undone.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Mr. Lee was a lawful permanent resident, so he had reason to ask those questions. Mr. Farhan felt safe and was relying on counsel. It was counsel's job. The onus was on counsel to advise Mr. Farhan about the denaturalization and deportation risks here. Mr. Farhan is a layperson. There's no way for him to know what the legal consequences might be of a plea. He's relying on counsel as he should, and he was not advised.
All right. Let me just see if there's any other questions.
The only question I want to ask is, we're looking at this case now through the lens of what happened in 2017 and the habeas corpus petition and all that's been generated by that. But once we get to the question of ineffective assistance of counsel, we're confined to the period prior to the plea. Everything, that's the universe, that's the context in which the plea was taken. And under those circumstances, I don't see how you could get to the point where this was the kind of information that at that time counsel would be required to notify his client on, because of the fact that it was extremely rare. You know that as has been cited, there were a handful of cases, really, even in the country, I think 150 cases over almost 40 years, and very, very rare. And then, and in addition to that, there wasn't a great deal of information that counsel had. He knew that his client was a naturalized citizen, period. He didn't know anything about the context of that naturalization proceeding, the timing of it, what he might have said at the time, whether or not he had lied to the INS officer, any of those things. So, and what's more, the ABA findings, and I keep going back to that, about consequences that need to be warned, did not even include this at the time because it was so rare.
Well, Your Honor, 2 points in response, and I'll conclude. I mean, rarity simply does not enter into the Padilla analysis. Not once in Padilla does the Supreme Court look at whether the immigration consequence is rare or not. That's simply not the analysis.
I'm talking about Padilla now. I'm assuming your point, if we accept your point on Padilla, and so that the Sixth Amendment means that it's not off the table completely, you pass the threshold, the Padilla threshold. You still have to show that Strickland was complied with.
Yes, Your Honor, and again, you know, prevailing professional norms. I won't repeat the points about that. To your point about trial counsel not knowing, I'll cite some ABA standards for you from 1999. The criminal justice standards required counsel to be active, not passive. Again, all counsel had to do was to ask a question.
Statements about that, but in terms of actually listing all the consequences, the ABA didn't come up with denaturalization as a possibility. And deportation was solely confined to non-citizens.
Respectfully, Your Honor,
if he had gone and looked at the actual ABA 1999 standards, he could have come to the same conclusion.
Well, Your Honor, the prevailing professional norms reflected in contemporaneous authorities cited by the Supreme Court actually speak of denaturalization. Perhaps they don't speak of it as much as deportation, but it's in there. There's a lot of case law. There were no fewer than 87 civil denaturalization cases brought in the 5 years preceding Mr. Farhan's plea. Now, if trial counsel didn't know something, and we think he knew or should have known, but he was really one question away from having all the knowledge he needed to properly advise his client and meet the constitutional standard. And he really didn't have to say much because of lack of clarity in the law. He could have just said something.
But there's Mr. Kassem, you would agree that once we're in Strickland land, we're looking at 2006.
Your Honor, absolutely. And I'm referring to contemporaneous record evidence.
That's a simple question. I didn't want any more.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It's contemporaneous record evidence.
You can't use hindsight to try to judge these cases. That's in Strickland.
Your Honor.
Mr. Padilla's plea was in what year?
2006. Mr. Padilla's plea was in 2001, and the Padilla decision came down in 2010. And so, Your Honor, to your point, just one last thing. Of course, the court should look to contemporaneous record facts, and there's ample contemporaneous evidence. But this court in Doe credited the 2255 affidavit. Mr. Farhan, so this court can do that as well. You can look to...
The D is 2010, Saga Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Farhan's conviction is 2007.
Your Honor, the Supreme Court decision was in 2010. Mr. Farhan's conviction became final after Padilla in 2011.
Yeah, yeah. And the pleas were 2004 and 2006, I thought. I thought Padilla's plea was 2004.
Correct, Your Honor. My apologies. I misstated that earlier.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, thanks very much. You've got 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear now from Mr. Metzner.
May it please the court. The district court's denial of Mr. Farhan's 2255 motion should be affirmed for three different and independent reasons. First, the Sixth Amendment does not extend to advice about the collateral estoppel effects of a guilty plea in a subsequent denaturalization proceeding because that is not a direct consequence of the plea. This court has long used the distinction.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but are you saying that it doesn't extend, the Sixth Amendment doesn't extend to advice about denaturalization?
That's correct, Your Honor. It does not.
So you were focusing on collateral estoppel, but really what you're saying is you never have to advise about the risk of denaturalization. Is
Your
that
Honor,
right?
What I'm saying is that the obligation of defense counsel does not extend to the collateral estoppel usage in a subsequent proceeding of a guilty plea. And so that's what's going on here.
Well, I'm still... So if counsel knows that his client will be denaturalized by virtue of following as a consequence of a guilty plea to a criminal charge, he has no obligation to advise because the denaturalization is collateral.
Your Honor, the Sixth Amendment defines what his obligations are, not his own knowledge or any collateral consequences. There are a lot of different collateral consequences that can be considered very severe.
I realize, but I'm asking you whether, in the government's view, counsel never has a Sixth Amendment obligation to advise that denaturalization is a risk.
Your Honor, that's correct. What the counsel has to do...
No obligation at all. It's collateral.
That's correct, Your Honor. They have to advise about the direct consequences of a guilty plea. And in the Padilla case itself, which is not the same as this one, what the court focused on was simply that the direct collateral distinction wasn't the best tool for looking at the scope of the Sixth Amendment. Instead...
But what about misadvice about denaturalization?
Your Honor, that's a completely different category, and it as the...
So misadvice about denaturalization is within the Sixth Amendment right.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's what Chaidez, in fact, said, that those cases, quote, exist in harmony with one another, that misadvice goes to the decision-making of the defendant, and that could involve lots of different things if it's wrong. So misadvice, even about something that a lawyer had no obligation to advise about, may very well have rendered ineffective assistance by convincing the defendant that there was something that wasn't true. And
so
that's why those cases exist for years.
Collateral effects are in the context of misadvice, but not within the Sixth Amendment scope, within the context of failure to inform.
Well, Your Honor, when we talk about misadvice, you're talking about what was the advice rendered as part of the criminal defense by the lawyer, and whether that was effective assistance of counsel or not.
I'm just asking if it's within the Sixth Amendment right or not. If counsel gives misadvice about the collateral consequences of the plea with effect to denaturalization, Is it within the Sixth Amendment or not?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely it is. Misadvice about many issues, including the collateral consequences for losing law licenses, for example, for being subject to restraining orders, being subject to sexual offense registration.
On the flip side, let me ask, in the removal context, in the deportation context, counsel made this point a couple times, there are non-crime-based grounds for removal, correct?
That's absolutely true, Your Honor.
So if you're in the criminal context and you're pleading to a crime that's not grounds for removal, but in the course of that allocution, in the course of that plea, you would admit to conduct that would make you removable in a removal proceeding, does the Sixth Amendment apply with respect to failure to advise with respect to that?
Yes, Your Honor. What the court said in Padilla was they wanted to make sure they weren't going to deal with those outlying cases. Instead of being concerned about those scenarios, which is the occasional case where the conviction itself is not the basis for a deportation order, the vast majority of the serious criminal cases in this country for non-citizens result in deportation solely because of the conviction itself.
But even still, even if it's not a direct consequence because there might be uncertainty or lack of clarity, the Sixth Amendment requires counsel to give warning as to that risk.
That they did, Your Honor, because
even
of...
Even though it's not automatic from the crime being pled to.
But what the court in Padilla said, Your Honor, was that it is almost always automatic. And rather than dealing with the edge cases and occasionally when it's not, the more appropriate interpretation of the Sixth Amendment was simply to say that because of the direct linkage between the conviction and deportation in the way the deportation statutes have now been developed, that it was appropriate to say that falls within the Sixth Amendment guarantee of effective assistance of counsel.
And so let me ask, Mr. Farhan's plea here, would you say that it substantially increased his risk of deportation?
Your Honor, I don't think it does. What happened...
Did it increase his risk of deportation?
What it did was ease the government's evidentiary burden in a subsequent denaturalization petition.
So there's a higher risk of things that are easier, are there not?
Well, Your Honor, it certainly eases the burden of proof. There's no doubt about it. The government's relying on the collateral estoppel effects in the denaturalization proceedings. That's absolutely true.
So therefore, those effects, you won't concede increase the risk?
And I won't, Your Honor, because the possibility of denaturalization was present before or after the guilty plea. It was the conduct that led to the risk of denaturalization, not the guilty plea.
So does it carry the risk, even if it doesn't increase it? There's a risk. It carries the risk, but it doesn't increase the risk, fair to say?
I don't know if it, Your Honor, certainly, the government submits that its evidence that supports the three claims in the denaturalization petition is very strong, regardless of the use of the guilty plea.
You agreed to stay the denaturalization proceeding here?
At Mr. Farhan's request, yes, the government did agree.
You're not proceeding.
If you didn't have the guilt.
Mr. Farhan was denaturalized because the government seeks to denaturalize Mr. Farhan because he does not have good moral character, is the assertion of the government, correct?
That's counts one and two, Your Honor, yes.
And the factual premise of that is that he committed the crime?
Unlawful acts, that's count one, Your Honor.
There's also another factual premise that he lied about it on his application for citizenship and that he lied about it during a citizenship interview, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Now, let's just focus on the lies. Can an immigrant who commits a crime and lies on the naturalization application, are they subject to a denaturalization proceeding subsequently when that lie is discovered?
Yes, that's possible, Your Honor.
And presume that this citizen or this immigrant commits a crime that's not the subject for deportation, doesn't qualify as an aggravated felony, doesn't qualify as any grounds for removal. There's no connection between the criminal process and the immigration process, or the naturalization process at that point in time, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
However, if someone is a naturalized citizen who commits a crime that can also serve as grounds for removal, then the immigration process, or the status of as a naturalized citizen who's an immigrant, who's committed a crime, and the criminal process have some relationship to each other.
I don't know that they do, Your Honor. And it brings me to a point I'd like to clarify, because my counsel
Well, why doesn't it become removed because they become denaturalized?
Well, Your Honor, the removal, the removal has to be a separate proceeding.
Right, but one doesn't, if Mr. Farhan had committed a DWI, or driving while impaired, which is a misdemeanor in New York, driving while intoxicated, we're going to go back to a misdemeanor. If he committed driving while intoxicated, he couldn't be removed for it. The fact that his lawyer didn't know a hoot about its effect upon his naturalization doesn't seem to be, it doesn't seem to fit the Padilla kind of construct.
It doesn't, Your Honor, and that's the whole point, was that in Padilla, the linkage between the conviction itself and the resulting deportation is what the court found to be so compelling and what made it different than the direct collateral distinction that it chose not to use in that case.
Pulled over for that DWI and they found a gun in his car. He was then charged with possession of a weapon, which would then become the grounds for removal. Doesn't the criminal process in the immigration process inch closer towards each other and become more Padilla-like again?
Well, again, Your Honor, if you're talking about a non-citizen, of course it does under Padilla itself. Your hypothetical, I believe, posits a naturalized U.S. citizen.
I'm just trying to understand how big the tent of Padilla is. Because what your brief says that this is Padilla plus, and you invoke Teague and say that Teague precludes these folks because they're trying to extend the deal. It's easy to understand the argument that Padilla fits nicely around the immigration context. I'm trying to understand if Padilla teaches something. Is it applying Padilla to Mr. Farhan's circumstance, or does Padilla answer all the questions?
It is absolutely a new rule for several reasons. First of all, Padilla itself used the word unique more than once in the opinion itself to talk about
deportation.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what we've been focusing on here, some of us, as deportation, the risk of deportation being heightened by the plea, or the plea carrying a risk of deportation. Yes, there's an intermediate step of denaturalization, but if you focus on the deportation consequence, that was what it was said was unique, and that's why it was removed from the direct collateral framework. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, certainly the connection between the conviction and the deportation was, in fact, what the Padilla court was thinking about. But I'd like to emphasize something here that I don't think was made clear by the defendant, which is Mr. Farhan's conviction is not necessarily sufficient to deport him if he becomes no longer a citizen, if he's denaturalized. The reason, Your Honor, is that he committed the offense, which is an aggravated felony, while he was a citizen of the United States. The government has argued in other courts and other circumstances that such a scenario, that is, an individual commits an aggravated felony after being denaturalized, is denaturalized, and now, having been convicted of an aggravated felony, is subject to being deported as under the aggravated felony provisions. Two circuits have rejected that argument. The Third Circuit and the 11th Circuit have both held that the aggravated felony committed during the term of citizenship cannot also be the basis for a deportation once citizenship is revoked. So the idea that Mr. Farhan has an automatic ticket to deportability is simply not true. It is, in fact—
Excuse me just a second, though. I mean, when I was looking at the denaturalization complaint, I was struck by the number of times the government said that the court has no discretion in acting on this. And this is part related to the collateral estoppel point, I suppose, but that the grounds for denaturalization are established. And, I know that there are defenses that have been preserved, but still, that was the government's premise in proceeding. And the Justice Department has advised us that the government doesn't seek denaturalization, because why would you, unless you intended to pursue deportation as well? So where are the holes in that chain of logic?
Two, Your Honor. The first is that the discretion the government is talking about is simply that once the elements have been established for denaturalization, then the court does, in fact, need to enter an order of denaturalization. But as been discussed here already, in each of the three counts pending against Mr. Farhane in the denaturalization petition, there are defenses that he has the opportunity to raise and will be ruled upon by the court. So nothing about his conviction makes the court have to necessarily enter judgment against him for any of those three counts yet. All three of them have defenses he can raise. So when the government was talking about the lack of discretion, it's only if once the government has established the basis for denaturalization. Second, Your Honor, and I want to emphasize that if in fact Mr. Farhane were to be denaturalized, he becomes to his prior status, and that is as a permanent resident of the United States. A permanent resident convicted of an aggravated felony is, as we've discussed here, almost immediately deportable, and that's the reasoning behind Padilla in the first place. But as I said, in the Hilton case and the Singh case, that's the Third Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit, those courts of appeals have said the government can't rely on an aggravated felony that's committed and convicted while the person's a citizen who then gets denaturalized to then say you've been convicted of an aggravated felony.
So you're telling us that some courts have said that it's not so automatic, but isn't that still a severe risk? I mean, we don't know how other courts, and this court in particular, might decide that question, do we?
Your Honor, the difference is the links in the chain are so substantial and attenuated from the original conviction that it doesn't have the connection that Padilla was insisting on. Padilla said, the reason we are taking this out of the direct collateral distinction, which I should emphasize has not been advocated to be abandoned by anybody in this case and should be continued to be used, is because of the direct linkage between the conviction itself and the deportation. And that is absent in this case. The denaturalization doesn't depend on the conviction itself, nor does necessarily even the deportation. The government will argue, and it has argued in the courts that I mentioned, that it does qualify. I want to be clear about that. I don't want to undermine my colleagues in the OIL. But the fact is that two courts have ruled that it's not good enough. So the government's 0-2 right now on this particular argument in the United States Courts of Appeals.
The argument in the denaturalization proceeding that he committed the conduct during the 5-year period before he filed the naturalization application, and so therefore he would have done it before becoming a citizen, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's the basis for the denaturalization. What I was talking about is the basis for a subsequent deportation would be the conviction for an aggravated felony. Sustained after he was a citizen.
I'd like to shift. We've talked a lot about the lawful permanent residence and sort of the deportation consequences of certain convictions. And we're talking about citizens and their risk of deportation, which is sort of mediated through the denaturalization process, naturalized citizens. I want to talk a thing about somebody who's here who's not a lawful permanent resident, not a citizen, but has asylum. So they're an asylee. Are they protected under the umbrella of the recognition in Farhane that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel includes immigration advice about deportation consequences?
Absolutely, Your Honor. They're a non-citizen. Padilla applies to any non-citizen.
Okay, but in the case of the SILE, if the mechanism for deporting someone with asylum is that you first have to terminate their status as an SILE, and then bring a separate removal petition. So it's a process that looks remarkably parallel to denaturalization followed by removal. I'm trying to figure out how it's different and why we would think that the non-citizen has greater rights under Farhane than a citizen for whom it's the same two-step process to deportation with an equal level of sort of likelihood flowing from the conviction.
Now, respectfully, Your Honor, they don't have greater right. They're simply different situations. And the reason is that for a non-citizen, the risk of the deportation connection between the conviction itself for asylees as well as permanent resident aliens is substantial because of the way the statutes are operating. The lack of discretion on the part of the government to stop it, the lack of any real defense.
If the government has to prove that you were convicted of a particularly serious crime and constitute a danger to the community of the United States. So in other words, there's an evidentiary showing above and beyond the mere fact of conviction. The conviction is a necessary but not sufficient reason for terminating asylum status. Why isn't that kind of exactly on all fours with the denaturalization as a first step to removal for citizens?
Your Honor, because the discretion in the government to bring a denaturalization petition is substantial and has been for more than 100 years.
Does the government not have discretion as to whether or not to seek to terminate someone's asylum status? Where does that come from?
They do, Your Honor. But the way the discretion has been exercised in the past is certainly relevant to assessing the directness of the connection between a conviction and the result, in this case, deportation from the country.
Is that what Padilla means by automatic? So opposing counsel said a moment ago that automatic just means the effect of the conviction once the government decides to bring an immigration proceeding. Do you agree with that?
Well, no, Your Honor. Padilla spent a lot of time in the opinion itself talking about how the immigration laws had evolved to the point where once an individual is convicted, in most cases of a sufficiently serious felony, that the process for that person to then be sent out of the country happens automatically. That is, there's very little discretion in any aspect of the process along the way before that person who's simply been convicted, without regard to the underlying facts of the conviction or anything else about the person, but rather the conviction itself being the basis for that person being sent out. So in the asylum context, Your Honor, yes, that's a little bit different. But again, what Padilla was saying was, we are going to assess immigration as it affects non-citizens and simply to say, okay, those are the folks, because of the connection between deportation and convictions, any person who's facing who's a non-citizen, we're going to make sure they're warned about the consequences of their conviction.
If the distinction that you're relying on is that Padilla protects non-citizens but not citizens, that feels like an incongruous distinction. I thought really what you were relying on is it's two steps, and there's got to be discretion about whether to bring to naturalization, and there's other showings that can be made. And those all of those considerations, I think they apply largely to removal of lawful permanent resident, but they clearly apply to somebody who's got asylum status, whose status has to be terminated as a first step, even though in practice the two are generally, I imagine, I don't have statistics on this, but my sense is that they're generally linked and happen kind of as a two-step.
Well, you are. I think they're both sides of the same coin. That is, the process involved as well as the links between the two. What Padilla said was, because of the way the immigration statutes have evolved, there is this close connection between the conviction and the deportation. And so we're going to ensure that defense lawyers advise their clients before they plead guilty that there is this risk of deportation.
When it did that, it looked at the removal statute as it related to lawful permanent residence. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, you're not saying that Padilla is limited only to that scenario.
I'm not, Your Honor. As soon
as you start saying there are other immigration consequences that lead to deportation that aren't within the scope of Padilla, then you have to have a principled explanation for why the asylee is protected by the Padilla reasoning and the citizen is not. And I guess what it comes down to is you don't think Padilla cares about the exact same consequences through the exact same type of mechanism for citizens where it does for non-citizens.
Well, I think what Padilla cares about is ensuring that a defendant is aware of a risk of deportation connected to their guilty plea. That's what Padilla wanted to do, was to ensure that if there is a risk that you need to know about before you plead guilty, we're going to make sure that you're aware of that before you enter your guilty plea because of the direct connection in many cases between the conviction and the deportation. That's what Padilla was most concerned about.
Isn't that an overread? I mean, it's just a risk of deportation. It doesn't say it's got to be a 99% certainty. It doesn't say it has to be two steps versus one step. I mean, and in the same breath, it's actually, you know, Padilla is actually talking about the responsibility to ensure that no criminal defendant, whether a citizen or not, is at the mercy of an incompetent counsel.
You're right, Ryan, but I think what's clear from the discussion that we've been having is that the court was simply not trying to deal with the idea that every single conviction will necessarily lead to deportation. Rather than have a defendant and their criminal defense lawyer trying to assess those edge cases about whether or not a particular conviction may or may not fall within this.
You have lawyers because of edge cases, right? That's why you hire lawyers, because every criminal defendant has a peculiarity in front of them that is going to require specific counsel as to the specific risks that he or she faces. So I'm not sure why you can just argue that these edge cases are not part of what we're trying or not, were not being contemplated by the DA?
Because the Supreme Court was focused on what falls within the criminal prosecution as defined by the Sixth Amendment, and that's how we have to draw the lines. What does the Sixth Amendment require a defense lawyer to do on behalf of their client? It has to defend that person in criminal prosecutions for their defense. And what the Supreme Court was saying and has said is that what we are talking about has to be something, as was discussed earlier, that first has to be determined to fall within the Sixth Amendment in the first place before you then take the next step to determine whether a lawyer rendered effective assistance in dealing with it.
Didn't the Supreme Court say stuff that has a risk of deportation falls within the Sixth Amendment?
I don't agree, Your Honor. I think what they said was the risk of deportation falls within the Sixth Amendment. And they said, but they said in connection with the criminal conviction itself. So what they said was, if you have a criminal conviction and there's a link there, that's what makes deportation unique. Unique to the circumstance where we're not going to rely on the direct collateral distinction. We're going to define the Sixth Amendment in a way that says, because of those two factors, the severity and the direct linkage, that that risk of deportation falls within the scope of the Sixth Amendment. But here, Mr. Farhan didn't face the same situation. Mr. Farhan was, in 2006, a naturalized citizen. The only information his lawyer had was that he was, in fact, a naturalized citizen. There's no evidence in the record to support the fact of when his naturalization occurred, or even more importantly...
But your view is, even if he had that information, no obligation to warn him of the risks, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. That there was no professional norm that existed in 2006 to tell a defense lawyer that beyond the idea of a risk of deportation...
So that's a rule that says, going forward, counsel knows my client's a naturalized citizen, knows when naturalization happened, knows that the conduct being pled to involves crimes pre-naturalization, and knows that there was a misstatement on the naturalization form. Better not to say anything, because there's no Sixth Amendment obligation. But if I do say something, I might misadvise. Padilla was concerned with this distinction. I might misadvise, which would trigger what you've conceded is within the Sixth Amendment.
No, Your Honor, I don't agree that it would be better to not say anything. In fact, the ABA standards provide for a whole laundry list of things that a defense lawyer should talk about with their client, including collateral consequences. That is not the same thing, though, as saying the Sixth Amendment requires them to do so in every criminal case. So I disagree with your premise that a defense lawyer would actually shy away from having those conversations.
Wasn't that part of the reasoning of Padilla in rejecting a narrowing of the case to misadvice? That if we make that, maybe not the holding, but it's part of the reasoning, if we make that distinction, it'll incentivize lawyers not to advise in that context, correct?
They certainly addressed that issue, Your Honor, but again, what Chaidez said was to make clear what that kind of an issue was really a secondary concern. The secondary concern, as we discussed earlier, about the misadvice itself being ineffective assistance by bad advice, regardless of the subject matter, if in fact it prejudiced the defendant and caused them to plead guilty when they wouldn't have. So the misadvice universe is simply a separate category than the affirmative obligations of the Sixth Amendment, and it can include things that aren't required. But the professional norms, as in the ABA guidelines about what is advisable for the defense lawyer to tell their client, that doesn't change what the Sixth Amendment requires them to do. It's the other way around. The Sixth Amendment defines whether a certain conduct has to be taken by a defense lawyer. And then, once this court is in the area of what the Sixth Amendment covers, then the ABA standards and other professional norms have a role to play in determining how well the lawyer did or did not do their job. So you cannot define the Sixth Amendment by basis of the ABA standards. It's the other way around.
It's a constitutional minimum that is enough to trigger the question. It's like a direct consequence if it's covered under the Sixth Amendment.
That's correct.
And then at that point, there's a whole new analysis now as to what the norms were at the time and what was going on at the whether the attorney's performance was reasonable under the circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, I know with regard to Strickland, you think we don't get as far as prejudice, but I did have a question that's related to denaturalization for you. You write in your brief that Farhan repeatedly claims that two of his children will also be denaturalized if he is denaturalized. And you say he's not identified any basis to believe the government will attempt to denaturalize, much less deport his children. But it seemed to me that under 8 U.S.C. 1451D, that if you claim citizenship through a parent who loses his citizenship by virtue of subsection A of this 1451, that you shall be deemed to have lost and lose your citizenship as well. And it seemed to me that that was an operation of law, loss of citizenship. I don't know kind of what follows in terms of deportation or whether someone might be able to regain citizenship, but am I wrong in understanding that that was two of his children at least will lose their citizenship by operation of law if he's denaturalized?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, and I'll explain why. First,
I'm not wrong, or it does not necessarily happen, or
it does not necessarily happen. And let me explain why, Your Honor. That same subsection, 1451D, makes clear that the only basis for denaturalizing derivative citizens is if the naturalization was procured by willful misrepresentation or concealment. That is one of the two prongs of 1451. Only count three in this case alleges that Mr. Farhan procured his naturalization by willful misrepresentation or concealment. The government could choose not to go forward on count three rather than counts one and two. And, Your Honor, the other thing is, even if the government went forward on all three counts and succeeded in a denaturalization order against Mr. Farhan, it is not at all clear that absent another proceeding with respect to his children, that that citizenship would be revoked.
But so I'm correct that as the indictment stands now, the charge now, it includes the concealment.
It does, Your Honor.
Right? And that flows through 1451D, and the statutory text says, shall be deemed to have lost and lose citizenship.
That is correct. Absolutely what it says, Your Honor.
Right.
But in fact, there is a proceeding probable that as any sort of important right, there is usually a due process element associated with it. So if there was an effort to revoke the documents of citizenship, for example, the Immigration Service has to give notice to the individuals, give them a chance to be heard before even, say, a passport revocation
so
or other things like that.
It's fair to say at least that they're at risk by operation of this statute, isn't
that
right?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. The possibility exists, but again, there are nuances here. There are a lot of steps that still have to happen, which is what takes it away from the Padilla situation, where it's just going to happen without anything else happening.
I'm not making that argument. I'm not talking about the Sixth Amendment right of the children. I'm talking about whether Mr. Farhan might legitimately take that into account. Or might have taken that into account had he been properly advised in assessing the risks of going to trial or not.
Again, Your Honor, there are a lot of things that happen as a consequence of guilty pleas that defendants may value over others. There's no question about that's true. But the real question is whether a defense lawyer in a criminal case whose job it is to focus on the criminal consequences for that client have an obligation to advise the defendant about all of those potential consequences that are not directly linked to the conviction.
Well, but Jay Lee took a broader view, didn't it, about whether the deportation consequences were of such a priority of the defendant that it was reasonable and rational for the defendant to take that into account in deciding how to proceed in his criminal defense.
Well, certainly the Lee case.
In a very personal way, right?
The Lee case had a lot of dissimilarities to this one, Your Honor.
He was aware that he might be deported.
And he kept saying that was the most important issue for him. And also, another issue, and it's important because I believe I need to correct my colleague here, that the delta between conviction and plea in that case was much lower. The delta here, to be clear, was 10 years. 10 years. He was facing 23 years in prison upon conviction at trial. His co-defendant went to trial and got 30 years. So the idea that he was facing only a couple of years difference is false based on the record.
Counsel, how do you explain his statement today about that it was a 15-year cap? How do you respond to that?
I believe he was talking about one of his co-defendants who pled guilty earlier to a single count of material support for terrorism. That was Mr. Shaw. And his plea was a 15-year total, and he got 15 years. Again, as a result of a negotiated plea with the government, just like Mr. Farhan had, a negotiated plea with the government that capped his exposure at 13 years. The third defendant in this case, who went to trial, got 30 years after conviction at trial. So the delta here was actually 10 years, not anything less, and that's what his lawyer achieved for him. His lawyer knew about the problems with the informant. He knew about
To find that was not, it would have been, this was not prejudice, and that he would have gone to trial we still have to put ourselves in his own personal situation and imagine that the alternative is being banished from the country where he has six kids and a wife and a going business. And it seems to me one might rationally choose, it's a low standard, one might rationally choose to be in a place where he could be visited than not.
Oh, Your Honor, I don't agree that it's a low standard, especially here 18 years later after the plea, for this court to then go back and determine what the defendant was thinking in 2006.
Well, of course, some of that delay was as a result of that there was no denaturalization proceeding even on the horizon when he pleaded guilty in 2006. It wasn't until 2018 that it was even a possibility.
That's certainly when it was filed, Your Honor, no question about it. But
you don't contend you could have filed it sooner.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You don't contend, do you, that he could have filed it sooner?
Well, Your Honor, we did not make any argument about the statute of limitations. We did not. So that's not the issue.
So if he had gone to trial and had been acquitted, could the government still have brought the denaturalization proceeding because the burdens of proof are different beyond a reasonable doubt as versus a preponderance?
Yes, Your Honor. The only difference.
Even if he had gone to trial and was acquitted, he still would not have avoided the denaturalization consequence.
That's correct. The
and
only
counsel, if a non-citizen goes to trial and is acquitted, can the government also proceed with removal proceedings against them?
Well, Your Honor, not based on an aggravated felony conviction, obviously.
But they can proceed with removal proceedings, right? What we're talking about here is the fact that the conviction alone is not the only way to deport someone.
That's right, but that's sort of reversing the issue that we're looking at. The question is whether, what is the direct connection between a conviction, if you're going to plead guilty, because this is about the advice to plead guilty or not, and this resulting events.
The fact that another option is available, particularly where the denaturalization complaint starts right out with he's indicted, he pled guilty, he's convicted. That's the thrust of the complaint. The fact that the government has another option that somehow undoes the effect of the guilty plea and conviction?
It limits the linkage, Your Honor. When in the aggravated felony non-citizen context, what the government has to assert in the PFR is this person was convicted of an aggravated felony. And that's pretty much the end of it. But in this context, what the government's saying is that the linkage between the conviction and the event of the denaturalization petition is not as well established because it's the underlying events that lead to the denaturalization. It's provably easier for the government, no question about it. The collateral estoppel effect makes proving those facts easier for the government. That's absolutely true.
Proving the fact that he had done a criminal act and then lied about it in the immigration denaturalization proceedings would be by clear and convincing evidence, whereas the conviction for the criminal act, either procured by trial through beyond a reasonable doubt or his plea, establishes that fact, but it doesn't preclude proving that he did a criminal act and lied about it in the civil proceeding.
That's right, Your Honor. That's why it's not the connection between the two events simply isn't the same, Your Honor.
And in the flip side, the fact that he's got the collateral estoppel, if it's used against him, doesn't necessarily guarantee that he'll be denaturalized.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Because there could be all sorts of reasons why he lied to the immigration officer. That would be justified. He couldn't remember. It would be embarrassing, that kind of thing.
Exactly, and that's exactly the defenses that are available. And my colleague talked about looking at the denaturalization petition. Every one of those defenses, Your Honor, is reflected in the denaturalization petition because, of course, the government asserts that they're absent. That's as you might expect. The government asserts that those defenses are absent, but it shows that they're there. The need for the absence of extenuating circumstances in count one, the need for the intent to obtain an immigration benefit in count two, the need to be willful and conceal a material fact in count three, those are all alleged in the petition itself, which the government has to overcome to succeed in the denaturalization. It's not just about his conviction.
That's why your success is substantially greater with the conviction.
Our success in proving the facts, not about the defenses, though, Your Honor. Every defense I just mentioned is not undermined by the fact that he's been convicted of this offense. He can argue extenuating circumstances about the offense. He can argue that he didn't lie to obtain an immigration benefit. He lied because he didn't want the world to know that he'd done these things. There are all kinds of bases that are not affected by the existence of the collateral estoppel effect.
It's also important that the lies to which he pled guilty were to the FBI. Not to the immigration
That's correct. They're lies to the FBI. And the recordings, I should point out, my colleague suggested that those were recordings by Mr. Alanzi. That's not the case. The recorded statements that are referenced in the government's brief were from FISA take, FISA intercepts of Mr. Farhan talking on the phone, not to the individual who had all the problems, which, by the way, Mr. Houston knew all about at the very beginning of this case and still recommended to his client that he plead guilty and said himself that he knew of no viable defense.
If you concede that the government's proof would be easier with the conviction, doesn't the fact that he pled guilty then increase the risk of his denaturalization, which is the ultimate purpose of which is deportation?
Well, I don't agree, because in this case, it's the linkage about the conviction itself and the result that Padilla was focused on. Otherwise, it's a collateral consequence.
But it would certainly, in terms of the government's discretion in initiating a civil denaturalization, the ability to use a conviction would make that decision a much easier one, correct?
I have to respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, because that suggests that the government basically is looking for the easiest case to make, and I don't agree with that.
I'm not suggesting the government wouldn't when there isn't a conviction. I'm just saying, doesn't that factor into a decision?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. It has to do with the discretion to seek denaturalization is committed to the good cause determination of every United States Attorney's Office since 1909. The U.S. Attorney's Offices have been directed to look past the actual factors for denaturalization and still decide whether it's in the benefit of the citizenry, is how the language worked in 1909, to seek denaturalization. Every single case is subject to that level of discretion. And only when it's appropriate to do so for the benefit of the citizenry does a U.S. attorney authorize the filing in light of an affidavit showing good cause to believe that an individual is eligible for denaturalization. So whether or not that a conviction has been sustained or whether simply the facts supporting the events behind the conviction, either way, the discretion of the U.S. attorney in seeking denaturalization, I don't believe, frankly, Your Honor, is affected by whether they got a conviction. If there are no further questions, we'd ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
I have a quick question. You said there were three reasons. You said one, and then you got interrupted. I assume we got to the other two, but what are they for those of us who are?
May I, Your Honor? Number two is that this would be a new rule, that you're asking, the court was being asked to find a brand new rule, that is to apply the advice requirement to the risk of denaturalization. No matter how much the defendant wants to call it a risk of deportation, that's not what we are talking about. The case law is incredibly clear that if you extend a precedent, that makes a new rule. This is a new rule. Third, Your Honor, there was
that's a Teague argument.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And just two questions about that. Is it right that Mr. Farhane raised this claim at the first opportunity that he could? Again, you've conceded there's no statute of limitations.
We don't argue that that's true, Your Honor.
The government did not raise Teague at the first opportunity that it could, right?
We didn't raise it in the district court, Your Honor. That's correct.
So under any principles of non-retroactivity and finality, why would there be a waiver? Why would there be a forgiveness of that? It seems to me finality cuts against you, not for you.
Not in this context, Your Honor, because it's not about finality. We're defending the judgment below. We're the appellee. We can rely on any basis that supports the judgment, including this one. It does not matter, and the Supreme Court
that's
said so.
That we have discretion to forgive your failure to raise it. It doesn't provide a reason in order to.
I respectfully disagree about forgiving our failure, Your Honor. What it says is that there's no forfeiture at all, that an appellee can rely on any basis, including one never raised below it at all, to defend the judgment in an appellate court, and that's what we're doing. It's not about you forgiving the fact that we didn't do it. It's simply the fact that we are permitted to do it.
But one reason why we might reject it is because we decide that it's waived, right?
I don't agree that it would be waiver, Your Honor. You could decide not to address it. You can decide to address the merits of the case.
Well, why don't you say something about what is the interest behind Teague that would mean that we shouldn't, that we should overlook the forfeiture and apply it?
And that's because of the attack on finality that a case like this brings. You're talking about reassessing the conduct of a lawyer in connection with a guilty plea 18 years ago.
Right, so we want to incentivize defendants to bring those claims at the first opportunity that they can, so it can be, if they have an entitlement to it, right, it can be adjudicated and vindicated
without the unnecessary passage of time. You've said that's not implicated here.
Well, I should qualify that, Your Honor. There was an opportunity for Mr. Farhan to do it. As the court recognized, his case was still pending with this court after Padilla was issued. His attorney, who had been appointed to represent him, had filed an Anders brief, but the case was still pending. Once Padilla came out, I don't think anyone could argue it got a lot of attention, and that it was described as an earthquake in connection with criminal defense work. His lawyer did not have any reason to believe that there was a meritorious issue there and did not seek to amend
his... And this court granted the Anders application post-Padilla.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It granted summary affirmance to the government.
That's right. And so...
But he didn't know yet...
Excuse me. There was no application for habeas relief in the interim until the time that he was released from prison. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. After the government filed its denaturalization petition.
That he became aware that he was at the risk of denaturalization because nobody had told him that before.
Well, while he was still in prison, one would think that he'd have an interest in overturning his conviction since it would set him free.
I guess my point, Your Honor, is that even the counsel he had at the time, who had his case on direct appeal when Padilla came out, didn't recognize this as a potential issue, which goes directly to whether Mr. Houston in 2006 should have recognized this as a potential issue.
But I think we know you don't really think that because you didn't argue that it's barred by the statute of limitations. So you didn't contend that that's a basis to conclude relief should be barred.
Well, Your Honor, it is a basis, however, to conclude that no one rendered ineffective assistance on behalf of Mr. Farhan, that not only did his trial counsel...
That's not a Teague argument. That's a merits
argument. Absolutely right, Your Honor. But the finality is absolutely a Teague argument. And undermining convictions based on standards that apply today in 2024, based on conduct that occurred in 2006, is exactly what the Teague doctrine exists to preclude on collateral review, which is what this is.
Direct appeals interfere with finality, too, but we think that you have a right... under the law to bring them. I mean, just invoking finality doesn't say anything, especially when the government was the one who didn't bring that argument at the earliest possible opportunity. It just seems to me that finality cuts the other way.
Respectfully, Your Honor, it's not final until the direct appeal is over. So finality is defined to include the whole period up to and including the resolution of the direct appeal. So finality is only affected after the direct appeal is concluded, and that's when the habeas motion gets in the way and says, okay, we're going to look all the way back, and when you do that and create a new rule that requires counsel to do something they had no basis to believe they had to do at the time, that's violating the Teague Doctrine. My third point, Your Honor, if I may, was simply that there was no ineffective assistance here, and I'd like to reiterate that if I could. Mr. Houston had no reason to believe that he needed to go any further than what he already knew, which was that Mr. Farhan was a naturalized citizen. There was no reason, he did not know, and there was no reason under the prevailing professional norms for him to ask that. When was he naturalized? And what did you say on your naturalization paperwork? And whether your conduct overlapped with the statements you made to the naturalization authorities? There was no reason to believe that Mr. Houston knew any of that or that under the norms of the time he had any reason to ask. Further, Mr. Farhan suffered no prejudice. As we've talked about here, Mr. Houston was well aware of the deficiencies, so to speak, in the government's evidence with respect to the informant setting himself on fire. In fact, he referred to that in the very first appearance that the defendant had. Nevertheless, after knowing all about all of those risks and seeing the evidence that the government got, including some recordings that were not from Mr. Alonzi, Mr. Houston recommended that the defendant plead guilty in spite of all of that. So there really was no legitimate defense that Mr. Farhan had to present at trial, and Mr. Houston absolutely represented him effectively and got him 10 years less than he would have gotten, which was what he asked, that is, Mr. Farhan had asked to do, which was to spend more time with his family. Unless the court has further questions, we'd ask that the judgment be affirmed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Metzger. We'll now go back to Mr. Kassem for 5 minutes. Kassem or Kassem?
Kassem.
Kassem.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Kassem.
Your Honor, my colleague argues that the conviction is not sufficient to cause deportation, citing other circuits. And I want to be clear about this. An immigration judge in the Second Circuit would be bound to order removal based on this aggravated felony conviction. That's under BIA precedent, binding BIA precedent, Gonzales-Muro, 2008, matter of Rossi, 1963. It is an open question in the Second Circuit, but even should it be resolved in someone like Mr. Farhan's favor, Mr. Farhan would still be deportable based on conduct that could be established via these convictions, including public safety, national security grounds, and terrorism-related inadmissibility grounds. My colleague also makes much of the fact that there are defenses to denaturalization. Well, there are defenses to deportation, too. And as far as the denaturalization grounds alleged against Mr. Farhan, we are at present not aware of any viable defense to any of the three denaturalization counts. And to your question, Judge Kahn, about the trials.
You're not aware of any defenses? So does that mean that we know that Mr. Farhan misrepresented his conduct in order to procure an immigration benefit?
Your Honor, I will say that should the conviction stand, we are not aware of any viable defense to any of the three counts. And to Judge Kahn,
so there was going to be an entrapment defense, and might that not be extenuating circumstances on count one?
No, Your Honor. That again, based on our research at this time, we don't believe that would be viable either. And and there's certainly no case law nationwide to indicate that it might be. Judge Kahn's questions.
You did reserve, I thought I read in the briefing that you reserved some arguments.
Of course.
To argue at denaturalization.
Of course, Your Honor. I mean, and if we're putting
so you're not position, saying you wouldn't raise them.
No, of course.
You're just saying they wouldn't be successful.
Exactly. We're not waiving them, but based on our research today, as sort of the case law exists today, the question about trials, Your Honor. My colleague makes much of the state of mind of defense counsel, but really what matters in the prejudice inquiry is the state of mind of Mr. Farhan. Mr. Farhan was not informed about these consequences. That would have informed whether or not he would have rolled the dice on the defenses that were available to him. And again, Mr. Lee had no real defense at all. The cases that I was referencing were all cases that were sentenced in 2006 and 2007. U.S. v. Usri, U.S. v. Stewart, U.S. v. Saber, U.S. v. Alon. Saber is a co-defendant who was sentenced 5 years below the maximum. The rest were sentenced concurrently, not consecutively. It is on that basis that we believe Mr. Farhan would have been capped at 15. But frankly, even if the delta were 10 years, then Mr. Farhan would have taken his chances. You need only read the 2255 affidavit and look to the fact that he is here in this courtroom, he is asserting his claim, and he is risking additional time in prison. What better proof would you need than that? Padilla itself refers to that as the significant limiting principle that is built into the nature of the relief that Mr. Farhan seeks, because from his posture, by seeking to vacate, he faces retrial and he faces additional years in prison, and that is how much his citizenship, his presence in this country with his family is worth to him.
So you're saying he's prepared to go be retried 18 years later?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And that could result in a higher sentence under the guidelines, right?
Your Honor, that is exactly the significant limiting principle that the court referred to in Padilla. It is a risk that Mr. Farhan is aware of. And again, it is an indication of the depth of his attachment to his U.S. citizenship and to his presence in this country. Now, Judge Nathan, you raised the point about misadvice, and I just want to be very clear about this. The Supreme Court dedicated the entirety of Section 4 in Padilla to this point. The silence versus misadvice distinction simply does not survive Padilla because it leads to absurd outcomes, including incentivizing silence of counsel. Chaidez does not say otherwise. Judge Leslie, you raised this question about, you know, some relation to the criminal justice process. And I think that's exactly right in the sense that it is in line with Padilla as we read it. When Padilla talks about the automatic nature of the connection between the severe immigration consequence and the criminal justice system, it also describes it in terms of a close connection to the criminal justice process, an intimate relation, all of which is present here. Now, maybe there is a difference in degree between what is happening to Mr. Farhan and what happened to Mr. Padilla, but it is not a significant or determinative difference in kind. Again, my colleague says that Padilla said that deportation is unique. I'm not sure where that is in the opinion, but at any rate, the Supreme Court itself likened denaturalization to deportation as early as now or in 1946. These are the only two particularly severe immigration consequences that have been likened by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has never mentioned any other consequence other than denaturalization in the same breath as deportation.
But I guess the Supreme Court has never blessed the direct collateral distinction that most other circuits and state courts have embraced. But I'm trying to figure out, I mean, and you're not asking us to basically overturn Second Circuit law relating to non-immigration related consequences. But why not? I mean, why wouldn't the threat of civil commitment after a conviction be even more severe than what than the you know, being deported is?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, if we're going to take civil commitment, we can look to cases like Young's in this circuit and other cases outside of the circuit. For civil commitment, dangerousness is assessed in real time, right? And there is a repeat assessment that happens even after the point of civil commitment, where a person can argue and go to court and go through a proceeding that might result in their liberation. Denaturalization and deportation is final. Once Mr. Farhan is denaturalized and deported, there is no way back. He's subject to a permanent inadmissibility bar. There are no waivers. Detention is mandatory. It's a one-way street. Whereas with civil commitment, there is a recursive process that could lead to the end of civil commitment. The same is true for all of these other collateral consequences. If you look at case law, and we did nationwide, the law is fairly well settled. Denaturalization and deportation are in the same bucket. The Supreme Court has said so. And if this court were to follow Padilla's logic, it would reach the same conclusion. So, Your Honor, if anything, the fact that denaturalization and deportation risks arise together in this case should really reinforce Mr. Farhan's claim to the Sixth Amendment's protections, not undermine it. And affirmance here, to quote the Supreme Court's 1964 Costello decision, would put Mr. Farhan in a much more disadvantageous position than he would have occupied if he had never naturalized at all. And that simply cannot be the law.
You've addressed the Sixth Amendment point, but again, we have to deal with the Strickland, which is a different calculus, a different set of facts. And that's the situation that I'm concentrating on right now, because even if he were to prevail on the Sixth Amendment point, you still have Strickland to deal with. And where is the performance violation or unreasonable performance conduct on the part of the attorney, given the circumstances and what was known in terms of standards in 2006?
So, Your Honor, in terms of case law, I cited cases that were available to counsel in 2006. Standards, Tubi, the IDP resource cited in our briefs, the information was out there. And as far as case-specific information...
But Tubi doesn't deal with warnings. It deals with the fact, just simply states the fact that if you're a naturalized citizen, you can be denaturalized.
The Tubi treatise was well-respected and cited by the Supreme Court because Mr. Tubi himself was a well-respected practitioner. It has all sorts of advice for practitioners in that treatise itself. And as far as the information with, you know, regarding Mr. Farhan, again, trial counsel knew all that he needed to know. He knew that Mr. Farhan was a naturalized citizen. He knew that the conduct alleged was serious and was years old. And he knew or should have known that he was advising a plea to pre-naturalization conduct. And if he didn't know that, and I think it's fair to infer that he did know that, he certainly knew that by January 2007, because it's in the pre-sentencing report. But even if he didn't know that earlier, it's only an additional question, and it's unreasonable for a defense lawyer not to ask the question, well, when did you become a U.S. citizen? Because at that point, you have absolutely all the information you need to connect the dots, and if, again...
But you're also then saying that appellate counsel was ineffective as well, right?
No, Your Honor. We're making no claims as to appellate counsel.
But how could you not say that? I mean, the appellate counsel must have also known that he was a naturalized citizen. By then, Padilla had come out. It would seem to me, how could you not reach the same conclusion?
The reason why we don't take issue with what appellate counsel did was because it was on direct appeal, and generally the preference is for ineffective assistance of counsel claims to be raised collaterally under 2255. Now, of course, the Second Circuit is a bit of an outlier in that regard. The Morrison case gives this court the option to entertain ineffective assistance claims on direct appeal, but it rarely does so. It really, the case sets out three pathways. Remand is usually what happens. In every other circuit, 2255 is the path, and that's the path that was taken here. But I think his Anders counsel may have been under the understanding that you don't raise ineffective assistance claims on direct appeal. You raise them because that's the state of the law in most every other circuit. Are there any other questions? If there are no further questions,
I think we got our money's worth.
Thank you,
Your Honor. I mean, a joke. It's obviously a serious case, but thank you both for the well-argued case and well-briefed. We will reserve decision. That concludes the.